I want to start with a little story. There was a group of friends that often would take their vacations together, and they decided one year, looking ahead a couple months, that they said, let's do something a little different. Let's go on a little bit of an adventure. They decided to go backpack through Yosemite together. Now, some of them had done things like this, and some hadn't, and two friends in particular, they'd gone camping, but nothing to this extent of having the backpacking gear and all that, so they decided they needed to get their stuff together. And so they went to REI, if you're familiar with that. It's a very expensive outdoor kind of place. And quickly, the one friend noticed the price tags and said, okay, you know, I think I can do my own thing, figure this thing out. So of these two friends, one decided to get all the newest, lightest gear and put it all together. The other friend, over the next couple months, kind of just grabbed stuff from his kitchen and got an old backpack from somebody used. And so the date finally approaches, and they had all thought they'd gotten shape for this thing, and they show up and drive up there, and they put their packs on, they start walking. First day was great. This guy in particular, with all the used gear, he was excited. He was looking at the flowers, and it was a great time of year, great weather. And they hike, you know, 7-8 miles the first day, and they get done that night, and they're sleeping, and they're all excited. And he wakes up the next morning, and all of them, you know, hits him. Wow, it's going to be a hard week. You know, soreness starts to set in, and he goes to lift his pack up, and it just seems heavier all of a sudden. But he's like, you know, it's okay. This is an adventure. This is what we signed on for. And so they take off early after breakfast, and everything's going really well till lunchtime comes. And his other friend that had bought all the light gear, you know, he goes to just see what his pack is like. And so he's going to move his pack, and he picks it up and realizes, wow, his friend's pack is at least half the weight of his pack. He couldn't believe that. And he's thinking, man. And at first he's you know, congratulating him that his friend did such a good job packing his gear. And so it's lunch is done. It's time to do, you know, 4 or 5 more miles. This time when he throws his pack on, it just seems a little heavier. And they start walking along, and he just can't help but just let his mind drift. He's not noticing the flowers and the beautiful mountains as much anymore. He's just his friend that's right in front of him, and he's thinking with every step, why does he get to have all this stuff? He thinks he's doing so well. Just what if he had my pack? You know, he would be going as slow as I am, And it's like this bitterness sets in, and he just more and more is no longer enjoying his time. And he's isolated from the group, and he's going slower, and he's just saying, well, it's because my pack's so much heavier than everyone else. And they just don't even know. They just don't even know what it's like to be me. And so they're going along, and night comes, and he's the last one to the camping spot for the night, and he unloads his stuff, and he's kind of quiet, and he's kind of separate from everyone else, and all he does is kind of sit there and think and stew in bitterness. And the next morning, rolls out of bed, and everyone's happy and excited. They've gotten over their soreness, and he's just thinking, you know, it's just because all you guys, you know, try carrying mine for a while. And so he throws his pack on, and he doesn't say anything out loud, and I think the rest of the group doesn't even realize what's going on inside his heart and inside his head. They're still having fun. They're a group. They're friends. They went on this trip to have this experience together, but every time they stop, he throws his pack down, and, you know, maybe they notice he's getting a little short, starts biting people's heads off for little things. And problem is, later that evening, they're going up this precipice, and of course, he's trailing behind, and, you know, as it is, they get done with their rest, and he barely makes it there, and they want to get going again, and that just makes it worse. And so he finally trucks up there, and he sees this rock, and he's going to throw his pack down and show them just how much he feels about this whole thing. Well, what he didn't know was that rock was right near the ledge, and he throws his pack down, and the weight of it goes off the edge and tumbles down the cliff, and he's looking at it and thinking, and everyone just kind of doesn't know what to say. Well, they were going to be camping at about half an hour. It's getting dark. You know, they weren't going to be able to go down there or do anything about it, so friends tried to do what they could. They kind of gave them little pieces of what they, you know, could do, but they were a little higher this night. It was going to be a little chillier, and he didn't have any of his stuff. He had this big, huge back, you know, sleeping bag that he brought with him that up to this point was really bothersome, and he wished he had everybody's neat, lightweight, little tiny backpacking one, and he's just laying there thinking, I wish I had my big, huge sleeping bag. And that night was the longest night of his life. It was cold, and he didn't have anything. You know, somebody gave him one of those emergency foil blankets, and he's trying to curl up with that thing, and somebody else gave him a few extra, you know, layers of clothes, but he's tossing and turning all night, and he just, man, if I could just have my pack and all my stuff back. Well, the next morning, they all get up, and he had a horrible night. They get their stuff back on, and they start walking, and he's just dreading the next night. You know, they got three more nights of this. And everybody's talking about how they'll give him food, and it'll be okay. Well, they go down the mountain, and it's about, you know, after lunch the next day, and there's a switchback, and they come back around, and apparently what had happened is the pack had rolled down the hill, and there was another group down there. Someone had heard the commotion and drug it out, realized what had happened, and set it next to the trail. And so they come along, and he sees his pack. He has it. Once again, and he throws that thing on. He's so excited. Suddenly, the next 2 days, he's got his joy back. He's just thankful. He gets to the next campsite, and he's so excited to have his big, huge sleeping bag and his big, huge pad that he sleeps on. He's got all his food. He's got all his stuff back. Suddenly, the purpose of the trip comes back into full view, that they're there to be together, to have fun together, enjoy this journey together. You know, the rest of the group had no idea what was going on in his heart, that bitterness had set in, that he was so envious of his other friend. And isn't that what life is like when it comes to envy, right? We're constantly in this tug of war. Our heart is in this tug of war between being thankful and being envious and being thankful. And as we are moving in this series along the way, I consider it kind of a journey. We're going into the wilderness. And Dave began this 3 weeks ago talking about the point of the wilderness in Scripture. Wilderness is that time where we are able to get away from things and really start to figure out what our heart is really like. Because when you reduce the noise, whatever music our heart is playing becomes louder in our ears. And as he just sang about tuning our hearts to thee, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to cut out all of it during this Lent season and focus on what Jesus would have for our hearts. And then we talked about Hebrews 12:1, about the sin that so easily entangles. And so then we launched into the rest of the series last week, beginning with pride, on really the seven deadly sins. They're the original, primal, foundational things that tend to pull our hearts away from God. And so, as we've said, we're going to talk about envy this morning. Now, the popular definition of envy, I'm going to throw it up there for you. It's a feeling of discontent and resentment aroused by another's good. Now, you might think envy and jealousy are synonyms, and if you were writing a paper, and the discerning teacher would probably mark you off if you were to use them as synonyms. They're related. Jealousy tends to be something that is about guarding your own stuff, you know, protecting your own stuff, and it does often lead to more outward actions. Envy is one of those things that just seems to reside within our hearts. In fact, I came up with a different definition. Self-inflicted rot is what envy is. You know, in the other sins that so easily entangle that we will be addressing, writers have pointed out that they all have some element of momentary pleasure. Something about them that is the bait that hooks us, right? When you think about lust and gluttony and pride and anger, there's things about it that we feel good about doing. And there's things that lead us into that sin. And of course, leading to further destruction. But no one ever enjoys envy. Envy is not one of those things that is enticing. Envy is, from the very beginning, a sickness, a rot that sets in. And from the moment you realize you have it, you don't want it, but yet it lingers and we sit in it. And that's why I say it's like a rot. And we know rot, right? In this part of the country, rot is a very real part of our lives. Growing up, I could leave stuff in a dry climate. You could leave stuff out all the time. You never had to cover stuff, never had to worry about anything. It would take months for something to actually start to rust. Here, I feel like if I forget a tool outside one night, I go out and I might as well throw it away. The wood's already starting to fall apart. Everything's rusted. We know what rot is. We know that when you set something in a hostile environment, it begins to rust. It begins to break down. Envy is that. It's a self-inflicting rot. It's a heart state. It's a heart sin that when we allow it to sit, it begins to rot our hearts. It begins to impact our relationship with other people, impacts our relationship with God. So that's what we're going to talk about this morning. I want to look at what is envy? How does it come about? What are the effects on our relationship? But we're not going to stay there. As Dave said last week with pride, he wanted to push us towards humility. Well, with envy, we want to move towards gratitude. That's the virtue we're hoping to see the Holy Spirit develop within us, because gratitude fights envy. Now, we're going to be looking at a story, much like the one I just shared, a parable that Jesus tells in Matthew chapter 20. But before we get there, sorry, Brad, I want to look at a proverb. Because this proverb, I think, agrees with my definition of rot. Look at what it says. A healing, tranquil heart gives life to the flesh, but envy makes the bones rot. So many years ago, they understood what envy was all about. That even when Solomon wrote the Proverbs, he recognized the fact that envy is a rot. A healing, tranquil, peaceful heart gives life to the flesh. When we live in contentment, when we live in an understanding that I can trust God with my life, it brings joy, it brings life. That's the abundant life that Jesus was talking about. Envy fights against that. Envy wants us to sit and stew in hostile, you know, acidic environments where it's you know, talked about the slanty-eyed sickness of just kind of looking at people. You know, that you lower your eyes a little bit, and you're just staring at someone. They don't know anything's wrong. They haven't done anything wrong necessarily. You just don't like that they're living better than you. It was called the green-eyed monster, mainly because it's thought that Shakespeare first coined that in Othello. He refers to the green-eyed monster. That's the first place that whole concept comes from. But even before then, envy was still considered the green sickness. You're green with envy because sick people tended to have a pale green look about them. And so even a long time, even the world outside of Jesus recognizes that envy has problems. That envy is not a state we want to stay in, but for some reason we leave it unconfessed. It is one of the most unconfessed sins because it pops up as we're living our life. We don't necessarily want to run to it. It shows up, and the question is, are we going to let it sit there? And so this morning, as we look at this parable as we're about to look at, I would just pray that if there is some corner of our heart where envy is allowed to sit, that the Holy Spirit might shine his light on that, that we could confess that sin that is wrapped around our hearts and is choking out life and is bringing rot. Let's, as we read this parable, as we discuss this, I hope that's your prayer. Because some of these things, pride, yeah, I'm a prideful person. Lust, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about all these things. Envy is one of those things that's just kind of, it just begins to rot from the inside out, and oftentimes you don't even realize, we've been sitting in it, and then you realize, my life is just lifeless. And then you start to look around, why? It's because this envy has set in. Now, we're looking at envy in the kingdom because in Matthew 20, it is a parable about the kingdom. The whole point of this parable, you might not think of it as a parable that teaches about envy, because primarily the point of this parable is Jesus teaching his disciples about the kingdom. They had, in chapter 19, he had just got done having a teachable moment as the disciples were arguing about who was going to be the greatest. And so he's trying to recalibrate their compasses to point to God and not themselves, and trying to reorder their loves and help them understand that in his kingdom, it was an upside-down kingdom. It was not run like the way the world is run. So this parable is mainly directed at these disciples to help them understand that if God were a landowner like this man, he would not run things like we do. He would not run things like we do because the world is merit-based. And what I mean by that is, for the most part, from school on, you get a report card. Maybe even the teacher tells you, if you do this, you get this. Because we have a heart that screams, I want life to be fair, right? All of our kids.
That's not fair. And what do we say back?
Well, say it louder. We all like to say it. Life's not fair. What teaches us that life's not fair? Life, right? Because it's not fair.
But we're born with this innate desire for life to be fair because we like merit-based life. We like to know that if I do the right thing, I will get proportionally rewarded. And we don't like it that when I do the right thing and the other person does the wrong thing, that he gets something better. That's not fair. And so the disciples, they wanted a merit-based system, just like everything else is, but the kingdom is a grace-based system. It's a sovereign grace-based system that God gives out grace, and none of us deserve to even be looking in the doorway of the kingdom, much less be a child of the kingdom. It's all grace to begin with. And so we have no room to complain. We have no room to compare, but we still do. And they were comparing, and they were complaining, and they were arguing about who was the best because of who brought the most to the table. And he does it gently, but he's basically saying, none of you bring anything to the table. All you bring is bad stuff to the table. I got to redeem your bad stuff. And anything that you're able to experience is because I, as a sovereign God, have given you a good gift. And so let's look at the setup in verse 1 of chapter 20. For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, so it starts about 6 a.m., that's the first hour, so 9 a.m. now. Going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and to them he said, you, go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you. So they went. Going out about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, so a work day for them was 6 to 6, so this would have been about 5 p.m., about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, why do you stand here idle all day? And they said to him, because no one has hired us. And he said to them, go into the vineyard too. Now this is, what I love about this parable is this situation is still around today. Day laborers. There is, in every almost every culture, you go and there's some place where people gather, where if you need labor, you need a ditch dug, you need some rocks spread, whatever it might be, some holes dug, you find somebody that you can go hire for a day, and it's the same deal as it was back then. They would go, whole group of people standing around in the marketplace, and they would say, here's my job, I need this many people, and I'm going to pay you this much. And they would make kind of a verbal agreement, and they would go with them. Today is the same thing. If you are a foreman of construction, or if you run a crew of any sort, you probably know where if you're shorthanded or if you have a special job that you can go and find someone that can come and work for a day, and you do the same thing. You work out the terms, they jump in your truck or whatever, and you take off and you go do the work. Now, if you're a day laborer, if you've ever done that, it's quite an experience. And in this situation, these guys probably depended on getting hired every day in order for their family to eat. And so you got up early and you were there. And if you will go hire, if you go do this, someone get pretty aggressive. Because it's the same way today. If you're working as a day laborer, more than likely your family is dependent on that money coming in that day. And so if you don't get hired right away, you wait. Because you never know. Someone may show up and hire you. That's your job, is to wait that day. You're just not going to get paid unless someone comes around and gets you. So they're standing around, and so for whatever reason, this vineyard owner keeps going back. Maybe the job isn't progressing as quickly, or he just loves to hire people. He continues to hire. What's unusual, though, is that late in the day thing. You know, if it gets 5 o'clock, what's the point? But you'll notice he says, come work, I'll give you what's fair. And so they go work. Well, at the end of the day, when the money is about to be handed out, is where we start to see some elements of envy in the human heart. And the first thing we're going to see is something about how envy comes about, and then we're going to see three ways in which it impacts our life. And we're going to notice that envy is a comparison sin among peers. It's a comparison sin among peers. It seems to be one of these things that requires two people, at least. It's a sin that It's a proximity sin. You need someone close to you. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's a reason why Lifestyles of the Rich and the Famous is a show, and Keeping Up with the Kardashians is a show. There's some probably more pride on their part than envy on our part, but both elements are there. But I would say watching Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous doesn't rot your heart. You watch it, you turn the thing off, and you go back to your life, because it's so far removed from us, right? That type of living, so far removed. But if you're one of those people, your peer group, you do envy one. You're all billionaires, but you envy the other billionaire, right? They just got a little nicer Lamborghini. You move down, the poor. You envy the neighbor. You envy the other poor person. You find this in prisons. You find this in monasteries. That it seems, in fact, if you're in a culture that tries to make you as equal as possible, where you're all wearing the same thing, you're all living in the same way, the envy comes even stronger because we so desire to distinguish ourselves from everyone else. And we so want to know that I'm living life a little bit better than you. There was a movie that came out a few years ago, that it was in 2004, called Envy. And I got a movie poster up there. And for most of you, you're thinking, this happened? No, I kind of remember going and seeing this movie. It was, you know, 4 years into our marriage, and we didn't have kids yet, and so we got to go to movies. And so I think that we went and saw this one. But it's got a really good scene in it that I want to share in just a second. But I'm going to set this up, because for the most of you, even if you did see it, it's not exactly a memorable movie, so you probably don't remember it. But it's one of Jack Black and Ben Stiller's first movies together. And the whole point is these guys are friends. They're peers. They're coworkers and they're neighbors. They're raising their kids together. They live across the street. They work at the same place. They carpool every day at this dead-end paper factory job. And one day, Jack Black comes up with this idea, and he makes it work, this invention. And if you see the movie, it's called Vaporizer. You spray it on dog poop, and it disappears. So obviously, it's a huge moneymaker. He's instantly rich overnight. Well, he doesn't want to move away from his friend, so his life just gets better right next to his friend. And the whole movie is about how Ben Stiller's dealing with his envy of his best friend that has now suddenly had such a better life improvement. And it's right there in his face. And so this is a clip that's kind of the point at which Ben finally confesses his envy to Jack. And I want you to pick up on how this sin of proximity, of comparison, shows up in what he has to say. So let's take a look and watch this clip.
Why didn't you tell me? I should have told you. That's the thing. I should have just told you, but I don't know what happened. I felt guilty or something. I was just so wrapped up in the envy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I have to add anything to that, right? It's I just love that clip because it's so real and it's exactly what's going on in our heart every time our neighbor seems to just have something that we feel like moves our supposed equality to inequality when we feel like our peer group has one-upped us. Well, the problem is, you know, obviously that's a problem in and of itself, but as believers, our peer group is other believers in the kingdom. And this parable is about co-workers that's allowing envy to come in and disrupt the unity. One of the primary things Jesus prays for his church is unity, and envy is a weapon that the enemy uses to disrupt our ability to come together and accomplish the mission. So it's critical that we really examine when is envy setting in and not allowing it to get to this level of where we can't even acknowledge when God is using someone else's life. We can't celebrate together. So we need to take this thing seriously. And let's look at how this comes together for them verse 8. So the day was done, and they all came together to get their pay. And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first." And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more. But each of them also received a denarius. Now understand something, this denarius concept. This is the usual pay for a day. This is a day's work of pay. And so when the ones that were hired at 6 a.m. were told, this is how much you were going to make, that was normal. And so then they started noticing people coming up. And so the assumption is they're going to make less. They're not working as much as me. So then when he brought them together, notice he paid the last first. So the people that had only worked an hour got a day's wage. And so if you were the one that worked 12 hours, you're sitting there looking at this and going, I guess the deal changed. I'm going to get more. But did the deal change? No. They got exactly what they agreed upon. You know, there's a lot of ways they could have reacted here. And I don't know if that warning sign went up, but there's a sign that says caution, you know, poison envy. Comparison kills joy. And this is what we're seeing happen, right, in this passage. And they're looking at this, and they're watching, and they're noticing. And they were, here's what I want us to understand, is these guys probably worked together on jobs a lot. They were daily, you know, there's something about the peer group, especially if you're maybe on a lower, you know, you're kind of at the bottom economically, or you struggle, or you work together. There's unity in that, right? You take pride in being able to be together. That's why you go to, like, some factories, and guys that grow up in the factory together, they're proud of the work they do. You know, they might not make much, but they go back and celebrate together. Their families grow up together, and they get each other's back. But here you see envy getting into their hearts and disrupting what they can accomplish together, and they start to look at one another and compare. And all because those first few workers made the assumption that the deal had changed. So envy starts to set in. This is why dealing with envy is so difficult, right? You can't plan for it. It results because of someone else's life. Something changes in someone else's life, and it's a reaction. Now, they could have reacted differently. They could have celebrated with their friends that they work with all the time that they got a break, right? Hey, you know, your family almost didn't get to eat tonight. You were standing there all day, and this guy came and hired you and paid you the same amount as me. That is great. Let's go celebrate together. They could have realized they just found a really generous boss. And instead of grumbling, kind of said, hey, what do you got tomorrow? Maybe they want to get closer to that boss who is so generous. But instead, they grumbled, they complained, they started to say, well, how come they got the same amount as me? I ran across this quote by a guy named Henry Fairley, and it's really interesting. It says, no societies in the past have ever so assiduously taught people to envy experiences that cannot by nature be theirs. And I read that in his book called The Seven Deadly Sins. And when I read that quote, I read it before I saw the year that the book was written. Because I read that and immediately thought of our modern context. Marketing, social media, everything is based on the fact that envy exists. In fact, if you've ever read or watched the Social Network movie, you get the background on why he came up with the idea of Facebook, and it was all because people want to know what other people are doing, and they want to have those same experiences. And so when I first got a Facebook account in 2004 or something, we got to kind of be in it early because we were on staff with Campus Crusade at Baylor, and early on, if you know the history, only a few colleges, if you went to that college, you got an account. Baylor was, I think, the fourth college, I think, that got moved in. Well, it was also moved into Campus Crusade because we were on all the campuses. It's kind of interesting. So if we had a Campus Crusade email account, we could have an account, and then like a month later, everybody else did, so it wasn't all that special. But early on, I remember, this is great. I can communicate with students. We can interact. We can do all this stuff. Well, however many years it is later, and I'm going, I don't even want to look at this thing anymore. Because it's turned into something, at least in my heart, where all I'm ever doing is comparing. And all I'm doing is looking at my friends that, you know, have this other existence. And I begin to really envy. And what's really happening is like these workers making the assumption that I should have the same experience as them. 1978 was a good year, right? The year I was born. And 39 years later, think about all that's changed since the day he wrote this quote. No societies in the past have ever so assiduously taught people to envy experiences. How much more entitled have we gotten over the last almost 40 years? To the point that we truly believe it is our God-given right that no one have an experience better than our own. Think about all the different facets of our society where this is reinforced. But it is not a biblical concept at all. In fact, as we read, as we learned about last week and the week before, we're all given a different race. We all have the same goal. We all have the same finish line, but our races are unique to us. And it's a unique relationship between us and God. Jesus said we all have this cross to bear, right? We all have our crosses. We don't have a joint cross. It is all linked to his cross, right? We join in his suffering. We are equal to his cross. We're equal in the fact that we all need a Savior. We're equal in the fact that we're all brothers and sisters, but the race that we're given to run on this earth, it isn't the same. The burdens that each of us are to bear, it is not the same. And we can look around and we can, like that hiker in the story, and start to spend all of our time staring at other people's burdens. And this is where we start to see what envy does because of the comparison sin. The first thing we see is that envy kills our joy. Envy kills our joy. It not only does that, as it says up there, it calls grace unfair. Remember, the slogan for envy is life should be fair. It's not just a slogan, it's a right. Life should be fair. If I do my part, I should receive what I deserve. And we should all kind of be equal. We should all get equal things. And I don't like when I see that you've been given a gift. And God's grace, therefore, is unfair because he has been gracious to someone. He's been gracious to me, and I don't like the way he has manifested his grace to my neighbor. I want his experience. It blinds us to the grace we've been given. These guys could have realized, you know what? I could have stood in that marketplace all day and went home and told my family, I guess, you know, we're not going to eat tonight. They were given a job. They were given a job, and they were paid the wage that they got paid when they did that job. Exactly the deal that they set up. But instead, they saw someone else's experience and they forgot to celebrate the fact that they have been given grace as well, that they have been given good things. And that backpacker, you know, it wasn't until he lost his pack and got it back again that suddenly he was grateful. Look in verse 11. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day in the scorching heat. They grumbled at the master. This is another way of saying envy had killed their joy. That first song we sang about trading our sickness for joy. Envy makes us return it. Envy says, go get your sickness back. Turn your joy in to sickness. They had been given work. They had been given means to feed their families. They had been given an experience where their friends were given a gift. And they could have all come together and it could have unified them. Instead, it split them apart and they grumbled. And isn't that the language of envy? We grumble. Grumble, that's the noise of grumbling. It's not quite audible. We don't quite want to say the words out loud. It's just kind of grumbling. You know, I there's a couple things when I find out that this is happening in my heart. One, it seems to become aware when I start to realize life just seems to be less joyful, and I think, you know, my life hasn't changed at all, but yet there's no joy. Why? And so I have to look around and say, what's going on? And then I start to notice that something else changed. I became aware of someone else. You know, I saw someone else's life or, you know, something, and that comparison set in, and I start to think too heavily on that. And then, but the thing that shakes me out of that so often is realizing, you know, someone else is probably looking at me in the same way. Someone else is saying, oh, I wish I just had his life. And I'm over here going, it's like the sisters where one is born with straight hair and the other with curly, right? And the straight hair person buys a curler and the curly hair person buys a straightener because they're just looking at each other and saying, I wish I had that. But when it's all gone and you look back and realize, now I can be grateful. I just realized we're really late, so I'm going to move on. Verse 13. And he replied to one of them, friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I choose to give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I want? Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity? Or yours might say, do you have an evil eye or are you envious? The evil eye concept is where we get our concept of being envious. Do you begrudge me? Envy makes us despise God's generosity and his wisdom. We start to doubt that he is a good manager of his kingdom, and we start to say, we accuse God. We ask him a couple questions. We say, why is my burden so heavy and why is his burden so light? We say, why not me? Why him? Why did he get this and why did I get that? We start to despise his gifts. Because here's the thing, when we envy other people, but we also acknowledge the fact that God is sovereign and he's the one that gives things, then therefore we are despising the gift giver, not just the gift. So here's the end of the matter, right? Now, contentment seems like it's the opposite of envy. You know, if I'm content, I'm not envious. But here's the thing, gratitude. What does gratitude do? I have a slide up here for what gratitude does. Pursues envy and destroys it. Look at this last verse that I want to close with. And it's in Hebrews 12. It's gratitude in the kingdom of what we want to talk about. And a couple weeks ago when we started in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, we talked about running this race that was set before us and getting rid of the sin that so easily entangles. Well, now this is the end of the chapter, and the whole chapter he's talking about the kingdom and how it cannot be shaken. And so he finishes with this, therefore, since we receive a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us have gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe. For our God is a consuming fire. Let us have gratitude. Since we received a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have gratitude. Gratitude is the thing that pursues envy and destroys it in the kingdom. And if envy is something that disrupts our unity in the kingdom, it's very high up on the list of things that God wants us to deal with and to reorder and to let the Holy Spirit find. Because as we have this self-inflicting rot, right, gratitude is the thing that wakes us up to what we actually have and changes the way we see things. And I have three ways that gratitude changes us, and this is how we're going to end. Gratitude, first of all, it's focused on the eternal. We've been given a kingdom that cannot be shaken because it's based on eternal things. and not temporal things. The world is based on temporary things. And anytime I want to go around and I get envious of something I don't have, I have to be reminded of the fact that all this stuff is going away. It's all temporary. I've been given entrance into a kingdom that is eternal. And when we live out gratitude, our eyes get set on the eternal perspective. We stop worrying and being preoccupied with our own situation, our own stuff, and other people's situation and other people's stuff. And we focus on the things that are eternal, the relationships with other people, the relationship we have with God. It embraces God's sovereign grace. The one thing that stands out to me about the workers is they did not celebrate the gifts the other people were given, because I think for me, I have a hard time with that. When someone else comes to me and says, "Oh, this happened," I want my heart to celebrate with them. But instead, my default is to say, "Why you? I'd love to have that experience. Why can't I have that experience?" And before I know it, a few days later, I'm thinking, "Oh, my life is horrible." And that's the sickness of envy, is it ultimately says my life isn't good enough. And it's sad. That's sad. My life isn't good enough. That's not the abundant life Jesus promised us. And what we see from this passage in Hebrews, right? Throw the verse up again if we could. It enables worship and service. Look at this. "Let us have gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe. For our God is a consuming fire." If envy is a consuming rot, it compares greatly, contrasts greatly with God being a consuming fire. Well, what does consuming fire mean? Consuming fire throughout Hebrews is pointing to the fact that God is ultimately put in the place of judgment and refinement. That this kingdom is a better kingdom because it is grace-based and it seeks to refine our hearts. And when we live in gratitude, when we realize we've been given this gift that I did not deserve and I didn't work for, that I am lucky and loved to have been given the opportunity to have a relationship with God, the only right response is gratitude. If you have a gracious king that gives you a good gift, the response is to worship. The response is to serve in gratitude. And then that consuming fire that is God burns away all the impurities and refines us so that we can worship and serve him even more. Now, envy is something I feel like we don't want to mess around with. And all of us have been there, right? All of us have been in that place where it has taken our joy. It's killed our joy. It's made us accuse God. It's made us look at everyone else and say, "Yeah, if you just don't even know. If you had my life, you wouldn't be so happy." But there's hope and healing. There's grace. There's forgiveness. And that's the whole point of this. We don't want to stay in the realization that we're broken. We don't want to stay in that realization of, "I got this hang up." And so in just a minute, Ben's going to come up. And once again, we're going to have this cross open. And appropriately enough, we have green pieces of paper. And take an opportunity. And here's one of the times for this response. To even more so, switch gears from envy to gratitude. Maybe on that piece of paper, you just need to write something you're thankful for. The very thing that you've maybe forgotten. God's good gift. And so be thankful. Maybe for you it is a confession. Maybe it's a, "God, show me, where is this rot taken place? Be a consuming fire in my heart and burn out that impurity." Let me pray. Dear God, I thank you. I thank you that you've given us a kingdom that is based on the eternal, that is grace-based. It's not based on what I can do, because what I can do isn't anything. And every day we walk with you more and more, it becomes glaringly obvious that we need you. As it's hard to keep our eyes on you, and as we look at our fellow runners and start to wish we could trade places, as we start to look at our burdens and get focused on that instead of the one that came to carry our greatest burden. And so in this time, as we reflect on you, as we sing this song, shine a light on our hearts. Be a consuming fire in our hearts. And help us to live in gratitude of you. In Jesus' name, amen.